from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaseli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out who is daring to be different at the Stutz Art Space.
I'll get a preview of the new CD by Kara Jean Wallers.
And I'll take a look at a funny thing happened on the way to the forum at the Athenaeum. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Using unusual and mixed media, working through organic methods, and sharing a spiritual mindset about their work, three Stutz artists are putting on a group show called Daring to Be Different at the Stutz Art Space. Sharon Gamble was able to lure Terry McClatchy and Mike Swalski away from their studios for a few minutes to learn about the show, which opens on the first Friday of August and also includes Carol Myers.
All right, you already knew you were different before you and Carol Myers cooked up this exhibition called Daring to Be Different. What was the spark where two or three of you were talking and you said, hey, we're all just a little beyond the beaten path. Maybe we should do a show together. You remember where that started?
Well, I can tell you when I saw Terry's work initially, when she moved into the Stutz in her new studio, I was taken with it. You know, it had a feeling to it that was a little bit different, but much like what, you know, I was doing. And it drew me to her. And I've known Carol for years, and I know her work, and I know where it comes from. And hers is a spiritual type thing.
Mm-hmm. So say more about what you and Terry have in common in your work. What did you see when you first started getting to know her work?
I think that we've been at it for a few years. Our techniques, our developmental techniques are such that we can get to the point of preparing a piece together. But where we go from there, sometimes you question, how did I get there?
Mm-hmm.
What I do? She uses crystals. I use metal.
Mm-hmm.
She uses metal. I use paint. She uses paint. It's amazing that we're using similar materials, but we come up with such different art.
So it sounds like in both cases you're coming from kind of an organic place. Terry's had a reasonable description of your work, which I admit I've only seen online. I haven't seen in three dimensions yet.
I would say that's very much part of it. I grew up loving crystals, and then one day I had a space in a painting where there was kind of a puddle where chemicals had gathered, and I didn't know what to do with this piece. And so I walked in with an odd-shaped piece of crystal and looked at it. It was shaped exactly like that little spot. So
no
I
way.
Laid it there, and that's how it began.
The rest was history.
Yeah, so then I've been incorporating crystals in my artwork since. That was a little over 3 years ago. So, and I would say, too, in my work as well as Mike's, you were asking what was similar.
Mm-hmm.
We're both of us use a lot of chemistry in our work, I would say, too. You know, I experiment with hundreds of different products to get different reactions, and I think Mike does a lot of that with his metals also that give it a real unusual kind of organic look and makes you ask questions like, how did you do that?
Or what,
so I would say,
would this change the color of this,
yes,
if I put
so
these
I would
two
say,
things together?
You know, we're both, you know, it's art and it's earth, and it's chemistry, and so we use, you know,
you're crushing those of our younger listeners who are thinking, aha, I'll be an artist. I don't have to worry about math and science anymore. Not true.
It keeps it always, it keeps each piece like an adventure. And, you know. So.
Do you remember the first time you saw a crystal? Was it in school? Was it in some science class? Or was
you know,
it...
I don't even remember. I think for me it started with stones when I was a little girl. You know, mm-hmm. how you drag the stones back and make your parents look at every little one and tell
oh,
you
yeah.
how wonderful this little piece of stone is. And so I would say it started before I even had, you know, I was probably a toddler when I started with my love of stones. And so, and it's just wonderful to, you know, things that take millions of years in some of them to form, and get to bring that into my artwork to help bring that awareness of what incredible resources lie, you know, right at our fingertips and come from the earth, and to bring that into my art is something that means a lot to me personally, but I also hope that it would help spread the awareness of what it, you know, remind people what an incredible planet this is.
Do you, a process question here, if you don't mind my asking, when you are creating a work, is choosing something elemental, some metal, some crystal, some mineral form, is that just a matter of a shape and a size that you envision in a certain place, or is there something beyond that that speaks to you where you say, I want pyrite here instead of hematite, or I want... how many factors are there that come into play in that choice?
It's usually an intuitive thing that I just kind of, I have thousands of crystals I choose from, and I, most of them, I create the piece first, and then I'll go to my crystal cabinet and open it, and there's usually one crystal that just jumps out, and it's, and then when I lay it on the piece, it'll fit just perfect as if I painted it in.
Oh,
and
my
I know.
Gosh,
so
that
it's
so cool.
An intuitive thing. There's a few that I'm doing for the show. I'm going to have one that's a piece of agate that looks like a quarter moon, and then I'll have a couple trees that are getting painted as lovers in the moonlight. So there are few that I'll do a piece specifically to go with the crystal, mm-hmm. but most of the crystals are chosen after the artwork
the other way
is complete, and it's you know, I feel kind of divinely guided for each crystal. So
how do you arrange your cabinet? Is it by color?
By color. I have a drafting cabinet, a huge drafting cabinet, and it's 5x5, and each drawer has a color of crystals in it, so that I know if I'm looking in for a white one, you know, so I have many. I have a very, very large selection of crystals, and we'll have crystals at the show for people to touch and have hands on.
It feels like I need to remind our listeners that this is in the Art Space studio, so not in your personal studio.
Yeah.
So they'll have to come back
and
we'll see that.
Yeah, we can go into that more, but we'll each have, you know, parts of our work there that people can touch hands on and get
so
a firsthand
cool.
experience of how we put things together and ask questions, you know, what we're thinking. You know, I think Mike's got more to say on that.
Yeah, and I have a similar process. We've talked several times before, Mike, but I don't know that I've ever asked you how you store materials. Are they by color? Are they by texture? Is there something less rational about how you store your raw materials?
You know, when you search things, I look for different shapes and designs and sizes and things. I'll spend a day at a scrapyard, so to speak, looking for different shapes. But my primary three metals are copper, brass, and steel.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when I start a piece, I have no idea what shapes I'm going to use. I've got a kind of like a beginning idea. But until the piece really starts to form, I don't have any idea what the pieces are going to be shaped like. So my storage is scrap pieces that I throw into a box. Nothing like Terry's organization.
You were kind of giggling when she was describing how well ordered the crystal cabinet is. You're like, I've
walked into
her
studio and I've seen that. Mine's a little bit different. But, I mean, I am working with, you know, various pieces of metal. The funny thing is that I'm afraid of sharp objects. And if you
that
know
is
my
kind
piece,
of funny.
If you know my work.
Please tell me you're not afraid of fire.
I am. I protect myself very carefully. I don't burn myself and I don't cut myself. But the shapes of my art are very pointed and
absolutely,
very sharp.
Absolutely, very sharp-edged.
And I'm using a lot of heat and a lot of technique in order to get to it. So, no, I think that Carrie and I were talking about this the other day, and it's just a matter of when you work on a piece, you've got an idea where it's going to go. You get your preparation, and then as you're producing the piece, as you're finishing it up, I don't know where some of this stuff comes from, really. I mean, it just happens to fit a spot. There's a lot of cutting, handwork, and things like that that go into my pieces as well. But when it's done, it's done. I don't really know when it's going to be done. It just is done. And some of the things that you add, people ask me, how do you know when the piece is done? It's done when it's finished.
It's like,
how do you know that?
It's like when you talk to a wood carver who's carved a duck out of a log, and you say, how do you know when it's done? Well, when I've carved away everything that isn't the duck. You know, I mean, it's not rational.
Or anything you add to it's going to take away from it.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever those answers are. But
how often and this question for both of you, do you ever have false starts where you, this is kind of a big deal. You've affixed a mineral to a painting, and it's kind of there now, and you're kind of committed, or you've welded two pieces together, and they're kind of committed. Do you ever walk back into the studio the next day or the next time you're in and go, oh, no, that's not right?
There have been many times.
Really?
That I've walked into my studio, looked at a piece I just finished, and torn it apart and started over because it didn't meet the criteria that I was trying to develop. It didn't look like what I wanted to produce. And it's just somewhere along the line, I just got out of whack. What about you?
I would say that happens, not often when the crystals apply, but in the process, so many times, my favorite pieces that I've ever done are mistakes. There's things that didn't go exactly like
really?
I thought. And it just, I consider that spirit guiding me in another direction. And I just think, okay, so that's what you want me to do. And I just go with it. And those pieces turn out so incredible, which also helps make each piece so unique. I could never reproduce most of my work. You know, that's the really neat thing I think about when people come to one of my shows is, you know, this and with experimenting with products like I do, you think you're going to get one thing, I'll go to bed and get up and I wake up and it's dried and it's something totally different, so I go a different direction. But I love that. That's part of the adventure. And Mike and I were talking about this one thing the three of us have in common. I think each piece for us is a journey, and we do let spirit guide us, and so we don't, it's not a controlled process for us. And so I think as you come to one of our shows, we could tell a story with each piece that we've done. So it's very interactive art. It's our intention that this show with Daring to Be Different and letting people see that we use spirit and earth and pull that all together, that's what we want people to come away from our show with, and we hope they do show up and ask lots of questions and ask us to tell our stories, and Carol's pieces have wonderful stories with them as well.
How many pieces do you typically have in process at any one time? Do you stay with one piece until it tells you it's done? Or?
Personally, I may have 20 going at once, so because I do so many layers. One piece I'm working on has 158 layers right now that's ready to get delivered. So
wait, layers all of paint?
Different textures. I work multidimensional.
Right.
I use, like I said, I have maybe 100 different products that I work with. And so I'll just start layering. And then a lot of clears in between, a lot of metal leafing. This particular one has a sycamore tree that I textured the bark, and then I went into the woods and made different size leaf stencils, and so each leaf is layered one at a time on this particular tree, and then I paint, you know, I'm doing more impressionistic work in the garden below the tree, so, you know, it's been growing over 4-year process, so I may have several going at once, because you can only do so many layers, and they have to dry, so.
You walk into your studio one day, and you hear a tiny voice in a cabinet that says, let me go!
No, that's what sometimes I have friends and family that take them away from me and say, stop, you know. So even though my crystals are very organized, my art, my studio can be full of creative chaos because there's so many going at once. But the crystals stay very organized and tidy.
That's the tidy corner of the studio.
Yeah.
And Mike?
I don't
juggling
usually
all
have
these
any
sharp
more.
Pieces
no.
at the same time?
I have about 3 to 5 pieces that I'm working on at any one time. You know, I think that's enough. I get with different pieces, different shapes, you know, whatever, different designs. That's about as many as I can go with. So it's about 3 to 5 pieces.
You know, we talked a little bit before I turned the microphones on about commissions. You're working, Mike, right now on a fireplace screen.
I am.
How did that start?
It started with a consultation with a family that had seen my work at the open house, our big show. Went there to discuss a piece of art, and we discussed that as well. And I'm doing that first, then we'll do the other piece of art later.
Cool.
So, I mean, I don't think that I'm a fire screen maker. I'm not a fireplace screen maker. I just think that it was an opportunity to produce a really nice piece of art for someone that has a really terrific condo. So this is going to be an addition to their fireplace, not the prime focus.
Sure. And Terry, do you do a lot of commission work?
I do. In fact, I have 8 commission pieces I'm working on
now.
From some of them are still from the big show we had in April. I just, haven't had a chance to get them all completed. So,
and if one of the people who commissioned you is listening, don't worry. She's running right back and working on commissions
right.
As soon as we turn the microphone.
That's right.
Sharon Gamble with artist Terry McClatchy and Mike Swalski. With their colleague Carol Myers, they're creating a group show called Daring to be Different. You can talk with all 3 artists at the opening reception from 5 to 9 on Friday evening, August 6th, at the Stutz Art Space. The artists will also have extended gallery hours from noon to 5 on August 9th through the 13th. The exhibit will also be open Wednesday through Friday from 11 to 2, August 16th through the 27th. Find out more at stutzartists.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. This weekend is the release party for Kara Jean Waller's new CD titled Goodnight Charlotte, which she recorded with cellist Grover Peridot. The release party starts at 7 p.m. at the Indianapolis Arts Center on Saturday, but Travis DiNicola got his own preview when Kara and Grover joined him in our studio.
Poetry covers all the trees as far as the eye can see.
It's called Goodnight Charlotte. It's a collection of 10 songs that have been written over the course of probably the last 3 years. We've been recording it for, what'd you say, about the past year and a half or so?
Yeah, about that.
Mm-hmm.
How long have you two been playing together?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half?
We got together to do this project.
Yeah.
Basically. Well, she called me up to do the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
And Grover, now you're a cellist, and Kara Jean, vocals and guitar. Uh-huh. Do you also both do something else on this as well, or is that primarily?
No, I'm just vocals and guitar.
Okay, so how did the two of you get together?
I
mean, it's a great combination. The sound is fantastic, the cello and guitar.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, we really enjoy it, so I'm glad you do, too.
Absolutely.
I was a bass player for a really long time and sort of a closet songwriter, and I started playing some songs that I had written and was encouraged to put them on an album and decided that I wanted to do it, and sort of kept them close for a while until I really knew what direction I wanted to take. And I went to see Grover play in a band called Blueprint Music at the Riverfront Stage, where we're having our CD release party, and just really fell in love with the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called him up and I said, hey, do you want to play on this album? And it was really kind of cool because normally I think musicians, when they start to play together, they're friends for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then groups sort of blossom out of that. But with Grover, we started strictly with a professional relationship and became friends now. So
Grover, were you familiar with Kara Jean's music beforehand, or sort of you got this call out of the blue and thought, who is this lady? Or?
Well, I knew of Kara. I had never heard her songs before.
Mm-hmm.
But, we have several intersecting circles of friends over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I was certainly aware of her, but I'd never heard the songs before. And, we got together about a year and a half ago in a basement, and I started to listen to these songs and, did some improvising to them and really, really liked the quality of the lyric.
Now, tell me a little bit more about your background, Grover, because I mean, when I listen to the music and the songs that I've heard so far, I mean, it's, I'm not sure the best way to describe it, but I kind of think of it as sort of like this ethereal folk music sort of sound that that is great. But and the cello really makes it interesting. But I imagine that probably that wasn't what you started out playing as a cellist.
No, I started in a traditional classical background. I attended Butler University many years ago and studied with Arkady Orlovsky. And then when I got out of school, started experimenting with a lot of different popular forms. I was in, lived in L.A. for a while and played in punk bands and then played in cover bands. And then about 15 years ago, rediscovered the cello with folk music and the new acoustic movement that took place in the early 90s.
Okay.
And I've been pretty much hooked ever since. And so with the cello, I get to do a lot of different, play a lot of roles. Sometimes I'm a bass player, sometimes I'm a lead player, sometimes I'm a backup singer, and Kara's generous enough to pretty much let me do what I want on her songs. Thanks for that.
It creates, I like how, you know, when I was doing these songs by myself, I always felt sort of isolated from the space that the story occurred in, and the cello has a real human quality to it. Mm-hmm. It's a good approximation of a human voice at times. And so I think that I really like how the cello sort of creates the room that these stories exist in. And also I think it kind of adds like a second perspective. So like when I'm telling these stories, there's somebody else that's sort of responding to them.
Well, let's take a listen to how that sounds. One of the tracks on the new CD, Goodnight Charlotte, is titled Heroes. Tell me a little bit about that one.
That's actually a pretty recent song that was just what I think I wrote it this past winter. I guess, well, it's about snowfall, so it was just about waiting for the snow.
Never had the nerve to be rain.
In the car on the way back from Cleveland, and the guitar kind of sounds like the windshield wipers of a car going back and forth. So on these long, you know, long.
You know, I've
drives.
Driven back from Cleveland in the snow many times, and I can imagine that.
It was more freezing rain, really.
Yeah.
But
Kara Jean, tell me a little about some of the lyrics that you're writing. I mean, it sounds like you really have a story in mind with each one of them.
You mean when I start writing
them?
Yeah. I don't. They just kind of they kind of evolve out of you know, I get asked a lot about how I write or what my method is, and you know, I hear a lot of songwriters talk about you know, catching songs, or that they have a notebook that they write down lines and they come back to it. But I think that I like to kind of shoot from the hip a little bit, and when I write and explore these stories and explore these ideas sort of as I'm thinking about them, just like you would in a conversation. So I always do it by myself, and it took me a couple of years to lose the inhibition and stop feeling silly in front of my dog. But you know,
is that why there's an image of a dog howling on the back of the CD?
Yeah, that might be a Doberman or a lab. We're not really sure whose dog it is, but we have a couple of songs about dogs too.
Yeah, there's one called Black Dog on there.
Yeah, right? It's kind of about a dog, kind of about a tuba player, kind of about a Led Zeppelin song. It's, you know, it's kind of a, it's got a lot of stuff in there.
Let's take a listen to another song, Marks on the Earth. Tell me a bit about that one.
It's about sort of your heart breaking. It's about the moment that your heart just sort of shatters into a million pieces, and I guess I sort of imagined that happening as the smoke rising and these doves rising from it, and the marks that you know, that burning makes on the earth, like if you were to light a match or something, how it would just scorch the earth in that like small quick flame.
Sure.
The time that happens,
the marks that they made
on the earth in the shape of two lovely white doves that could fly over treetops to the stars, where they're free from the earth in a blanket of sleep that could cover their words. And I know if I try to come find you, that's where you are.
But that movie is actually, that song is actually in a movie that Grover and I just finished scoring called Paradise Recovered. It's in the trailer, and it's in kind of like a pretty pivotal scene in the middle of the movie.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Is it a locally produced film? Or?
It was shot in Bloomington and in mm-hmm. Austin, Texas, and it was written by a wonderful woman named Andy Redwine, a tremendous writer. And she was able to assemble some wonderful talent to produce this film. Mm-hmm. And we're really excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, with this Indiana connection, there are some musical family tree acts that are also in this film, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just a really strong Indiana connection. And we're hoping that the film will be in the Heartland Film Festival coming up.
I don't know.
I don't know.
We hope. I'm sure it'll screen locally.
But. Yeah. Cool. It just finished post-production in June.
Grover, tell me a little bit about the process for you as far as working on these songs with Kara.
Well, I try to, I really try to channel into the emotion of her performance. And mm-hmm. from night to night, the tenor of these songs will change. And I really try to tailor my part to how she's singing it and how she's performing at the time. So when we were in the recording process, we tried to capture a performance that moved us both, and then I followed up with tracks to try to underscore some of the images that she talks about in the mm-hmm. songs, try to provide some of those background parts that I talked about before. And I try not to overthink things. It's really hard. It's been the hardest lesson I've ever learned, but a good friend of mine, Matt Gore, says, think less, feel more. And I really try to take that approach to the tracks.
Let's take a listen to it's the last track on the new CD, For Me and You.
You can always find a little place inside for me and you.
I wrote this for a friend of mine. Is a filmmaker, and his name's David Yosha, and he's a very dear friend of mine. But I wrote it for him, and it kind of we text late at night sometimes, like kids, cause I guess because it's fun. But it kind of reminds me of, it doesn't sound anything like Tom Waits, but to me it has some sort of like Tom Waits sort of sensibility, like mm-hmm. you're just sort of pacing the floor and late at night. So it's almost a lullaby, really.
It's a slow waltz.
It's kind of, yeah, it's a slow waltz. But it's like a children's lullaby for an adult, I guess.
There you go.
Now, I've seen that on some past CDs you've done, Kara, you played the accordion before?
Mm-hmm,
is
yeah.
that right? But no accordion on this album?
No.
No, no. What happened to the accordion?
I get asked to play accordion a lot because I have an accordion. I'm not a brilliant accordion player. I can kind of, you know, do some fills and things like that. But yeah, I've played accordion before. I've played bass before and some piano and just a lot of different things. I think I started playing guitar just because I was writing songs, and it's a lot easier. It's very difficult to accompany yourself when you're singing on the accordion. Some people can do it brilliantly, but I can't.
I've searched all the world.
Travis DiNicola with musicians Kara Jean Wallers and Grover Peridot. Waller's new CD, Goodnight Charlotte, will be released on Saturday night at the Indianapolis Arts Center with a party and concert presented by Butler Sion beginning at 7 p.m. For more information, visit KaraJeanWallers.com, and that is KaraJeanWahlers.com, KaraJeanWahlers.com. That is, it's the eve of the dog days of summer.
Exactly. Dog Day Eve, I think that's what they call it. Or,
hey,
I don't know, you could call it something else.
I know something we can do to celebrate Dog Day Eve.
What's that, Sharon?
That calendar thing we call...
What do we do?
Canine edition, right?
Yeah, right.
Take your dog and go to a lake while you can.
We're actually going to do this calendar with a dog whistle so that your dogs can hear the whole thing right
I
now.
I love that.
Yeah, you won't be able to. But just a heads up that... next weekend down at the Harrison Center, they are collaborating with the Heron Art Library, and they are presenting Book Club, which is their third annual book arts exhibit. So it's all artist books created as original works of art by artists and featuring a lot of great local artists. Plus, they're also going to have a sampling from Heron's Arts Library's permanent collection, and that show opens up Friday at the Harrison Center for the Arts up there at 16th and Delaware. And it's also in conjunction with a couple other shows, including one titled Obsession Desire in Gallery 2, and the Natural Awakenings magazine presenting their first annual Natural Living Fair taking place in the gymnasium and underground. All types of fun stuff going on at Harrison Center for the Arts.
Sounds very organic.
Yes.
I love that. Speaking of organic things, let me see. This is going to be a stretch. Eating locally produced things, drinking locally produced things is kind of an organic trend.
Often organic.
Locavores and so forth. So I invite you to remember that you can go to Easley Winery to hear music on Tuesdays and Saturdays through September. They make summer last through September. All sorts of great local acts at Groovin' in the Garden at the Easley Winery. And if you've been there.
Yeah, delightful place.
Great little, it feels like someplace in Europe. It's sort of a little courtyard setting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, feels very cool. Nice local wine, local acts. Take it in while summer is still here.
Sounds like a great thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, something else fun to do. Next weekend, August 6th, 7th, and 8th, Heartland Actors Repertory Theater is presenting Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona, and it is going to be outside at the White River State Park. It is going to be a lot of fun. These are great Shakespeare in the Park concerts downtown, just off the canal. And on Friday and Saturday, the performances are at 8 p.m. and then Sunday at 2 p.m. And it is free, and you can bring a picnic basket and maybe some wine from Easley or whatever you like.
All right, now you've thrown down the gauntlet. I have to continue the theme of eating and drinking. And, you know, Devour Downtown is such a success in the winter that it's going on in the summer as well. It starts August 2nd and goes through the 15th, a couple of week period where many of downtown's most popular restaurants offer three-course meals for $30 and specialty dishes you won't normally see on their menus. If you go to devourdowntown.org, you can find participating restaurants and menus, and do be sure to check. Some also offer lunchtime specials during Devour Downtown, so yummy. Don't take your dog.
Don't take your dog.
No.
Next week we'll be in the full dog days.
That's
it is
right.
Again just Dog Days Eve. But we'll come back with some of those hounds on
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
And 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. Last week, we had some technical difficulties, and the following interview only aired on our Friday night show, so we are going to replay it now. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, on the way to the Athenaeum, a leading character from this classical musical comedy morphed from a man to a woman. Director Bob Harbin and actress Claire Wilcher, who bends gender and plays Pseudolus, came in to tell Sharon why it's tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight.
So, Bob, I want to start with, talk about theater at the Athenaeum. Are you developing a series? Are you just doing a show at a time now? What's going on there?
We are basically trying to do one show at a time. If we can pull that off, it will be a miracle. But the Athenaeum was very kind in inviting us to come back and do shows there. They were very pleased with the shows that had been done there before.
Mm-hmm.
So they have helped us come up with a rental situation that we could afford, at least, you know, for someone just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working together in order to give them, too, still that character that they still have shows going on. Their character was a bad word. But they still have a theater presence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that they really want, that they don't want the city to think that they become strictly a rental palace and it's just one-nighters here and there. They really do want the community to know that they can come back there and still see good theater.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a community-based organization.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Who all comprises We?
We, pretty much John, Austin Butch, and myself. I think John is a genius, and I think that musically there is, you know, bar none, he is the best arranger, conductor, music mentalist that we have in this fair city, and I'm so fortunate to be able to work with him. We have a great collaboration with each other. We know when to shut up and let the other person, you know, take over. And we also know when to say, you know, hey, that's a really lousy idea that you just had.
Mm-hmm.
And work with that so that it becomes something good. But so for now, it's John and I.
Technical question. Are you operating as a 501c3, or how are you?
Yes. We are, again, fortunate in that the Docents Club at the Athenaeum has adopted me as their production arm.
Oh.
So the Docents at the Athenaeum are indeed a not-for-profit, so therefore we can operate as a not-for-profit while I'm trying to decide if this is actually going to, you know, be successful
become
or not.
Become a full-blown year-round
and
series,
a
yeah.
not-for-profit organization myself.
Ramp back up and get donations and grants and
absolutely.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, fortunately, you're lucky. You have a background as someone, as an entrepreneur, as an impresario who can pull together disparate elements and put on a show, literally put on a show.
And it helps. I mean, it. I have learned so many things I really didn't want to learn.
For example?
Well, if you call up the box office number, it's also my home number. So if the call comes in at 6:30 in the morning, I kind of, hello? Is this the box office? Oh, yeah, but it's 6:30. What are you... So they're anticipating a machine or something where they
sure.
can get some information. But, yes, it's been a terrific help to know different, you know, where arms and legs go. But you know what? Again, I think I'm really not afraid to ask for help. So there are a lot of people that have been terrific in helping us out. Including, you know, yourself in helping put the word out, which is terrific.
So are you and John are just saying, here's a show we've always wanted to do, or here's my list of 20 fabulous shows that I've always wanted to do. You write down your list in secret, I'll write down my list, and let's compare them and see what shows up on both lists. How has that been working? And specifically, how did you decide on Forum?
Well, since we're at the beginning, we're trying to be careful not to set ourselves up for failure right away. So we're not doing a lot of Lorca plays, which is, you know, probably sad for all of you Spanish. But
sometimes,
I love them. Oh, good production of the Red Stag,
yeah,
every time. It just gets me.
Sometime we'll talk about a former artistic director at the IRT who came into town and opened with an amazing play that that nobody saw.
There but, No, there are wonderful and plays. Actually, I think it would be great to get away from just musicals and do plays that have music, you know, combined with them. Where I don't think we do the classics enough in Indianapolis. It would be great, you know, to do some Lillian Hellman and some Ibsen and something, and find a twist, you know, and a reason to update it, or a reason to do it. But at the beginning, we're trying to just establish ourselves, get people to know that we're, you know, that we're up and running, and try not to do anything so distant that we alienate the audience. So initially, we'll probably do a little more popular titles, and then we'll be able to do The Little Foxes and hopefully still get an audience and at the same time not be dependent upon it. Forum came up because of this beautiful woman sitting next to me. I've worked with her a couple times, and I just think that she's the bee's knees. I mean, I think she's just amazingly talented.
Aww.
And it was a situation where there's this play that I think is hilarious, that's a lot of fun, that people really tend to enjoy, and it had never been done in Indianapolis with a woman in the leading role. Once on Broadway with Whoopi Goldberg, but it hasn't been done much since then. And I think it's interesting to see to twist things a little bit, see how the humor is rearranged a little bit, you know, bend the gender just a tad, and I think that she's completely qualified to do something, you know, that where the whole show is dependent upon this one character.
Claire, talk about Forum. Would you remember the first time you saw it, or the first time you became aware of it? Why you like it?
You know, the first time I became aware of it, I remember Footlight Musicals did a production of it a few years ago, and honestly, it was the first time I had ever seen a production in full. And it is just a comedic masterpiece as far as every character is a great comedic role. You root for everyone. There's really a lot of technique involved and concentration, and it's not just silly falling down, which... you know, you want to make it look like it is, but there's so much more to it than that. That's the first time I had ever really invested in it and studied it as a comedic piece. But honestly, to even consider doing that role was only brought up to me by Bob. I mean, I knew that Whoopi had done it on Broadway, and Nathan Lane obviously did the revival of it and won the Tony and all that. And did he win the Tony?
He did.
He won the Tony, and rightfully so. But
in fact, every man that's ever played Pseudolus on Broadway has won the Tony for Best Actor.
Fun fact.
No pressure.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Exactly.
Well, let's talk about, for somebody who's never seen it, maybe, the plot and that role particularly, and kind of what is the message is too heavy a word, but there's a point to the show.
I think the biggest message is that eunuchs are people, too, and we need to... pay more attention to those card-carrying eunuchs out there. Who
and we're not talking about the operating system, geeks. No. Shut up. It's not you.
It's about freedom. You have a slave, Pseudolus, who is desperate for his freedom and willing to do anything, you know, in his or her
Thank you.
Abilities. Yes, you're welcome. Yeah. We are not playing it as a woman playing a man.
No.
It is a woman,
right.
All woman. But she's desperate for her freedom, and she wants that more than anything else. And so when someone wants something that badly, I think zany hijinks abound as she spends, you know, about 2 hours trying to achieve it on one sunny Roman afternoon in the times of Nero.
I have to ask, because it's such an obvious question, does it take on a feminist cast then? Because
I think it could. We are exploring that, and I think, you know, as an actor, that's something that I'm studying when I'm studying the script. And when we're doing certain scenes, I think that's something that definitely has to come up. As in the script, we're changing lines from man to woman and lyrics that we have to maybe say a lyric that is a little bit different just to tweak it. I think it's inevitable. So I think that there's a lot of fun that can come from that.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
And I should mention, as we're having this conversation, you're still in the early phases of rehearsal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was it hard to cast this locally?
It was a blast. Again, since we're not part of a big company yet, we actually thought, if we had our druthers and could cast a show with people that we just know are fun people to work with,
mm-hmm.
let alone talented, which is, you know, we lucked into both categories. But we went out and we asked people, we didn't have open auditions for this particular show. We asked people if they would come on board and play with us for this production. We got an amazing number of yeses. We have a cast that from all different theaters in town. If you think that any one theater is given to using the same people over and over again, this will dispel all of that immediately. We have folks that you're used to seeing it at Civic or and Theater on the Square and the Phoenix, and we've all come together and just laugh. You know, we have to make sure that we get work done, but we're having a great time with each other, which I think, you know, is good news as far as the production's concerned.
Mm-hmm. Have you directed this before or been involved?
I have not.
In
I was in
before?
It once.
You
I
were.
Played I played Cynics once many years ago.
Back in the day.
is there anything you have to try to forget then as you have a new approach and a new, literally a new role?
What I'm really looking forward, I have, what's great is there's three houses, and that's it. That's the set. So it's not a show that is dependent upon the set. A lot of the action takes place in the foreground there.
Mm-hmm.
So what I really look forward to is giving up every preconceived idea I've had about it and let these masters that we have working in the show, let them take over and simply be an editor. You know, just go crazy. Do what you think is terrific, and I'll just sort of sit back here, pull from here, pull from, you know, like a Chinese restaurant. I'll take three from column A and one from column B. And I think that's going to be, that's the invitation that's here, and I'm prepared to do that and just let me stay out of the way.
Hmm. Claire, are you ever tempted to go over the top in this role? Or is it possible to?
I think it's very possible to, and that is what I am afraid to do, quite honestly. When Bob approached me about this opportunity, I didn't hesitate to get on board with it because, you know, I think Bob's brilliant, and he's got this background that is just amazing. That really is a blessing for actors who want to do the best they can. So I didn't hesitate because of that, but I did hesitate because it is very farcical, and it does lend itself to lots of over the top, lots of mugging, lots of how wacky can we make this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I myself am a very physical comedian. I am very goofy and I'm very animated, but it's going to be interesting to try to rein that in and not make it about how goofy we can look, but how smart we can make it and how intelligent the comedy can be, and let that tell its own story.
So you got to pull it back. No offense, because I know guys tend to like the Three Stooges, but pull it back from the Three Stooges and over into Marx Brothers territory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
where there's
that's
physical
very good.
Comedy,
very
but also the intellect.
Yes.
Very appropriate.
Favorite line, favorite song?
Well, right now, my favorite song is Comedy Tonight, just because it's such an iconic Broadway song. Everyone knows it, even if you don't know the show. Everybody knows that because it is the perfect opening song, in that it just basically tells what's going to happen, but in a really huge, huge way. And right now, that's my favorite. I think it probably will vary from night to night and from show to show. But right now, I think that's going to be the best one because it will have all the energy of, wow, the curtain just came up. Here we go.
Yes.
So
hang
that's
on.
My favorite. Yeah, it's my favorite moment anyway. It's like the top of the roller coaster. Get ready.
I don't know if it'll, yes, the line is no. and it comes in act two and it's amazing. No. I don't know if it will transfer, but there's a part. What's terrific is in many of the characters are called upon to become different characters within the play. We actually have three actors who play Proteans, and as the script says, they're three, but they play 30, and they do. They're all the townspeople. They're everything that fills in the show. But each character within the show many times is called upon to be someone else, because mm-hmm. it's a lot of, of, of misrepresentations of characters. And anyway, so there's at one point, Pseudolus is listening to two characters, and that the character believes that there's a ghost in his house, mm-hmm. and actually, well, we changed that character and to her house,
mm-hmm.
Another woman switcher, but Vonda Furman is playing a role that is normally played by a man. There's a ghost in my house. I need a soothsayer.
I have come to say the sooth.
And that's my...
Pseudolus comes and acts as if she is the soothsayer. And
oh, yeah. goes crazy. And then I'm about to say the sooth. And then, I don't know. It just makes me laugh.
It's a funny scene. There's pantomiming. There's hidden identities. There's hijinks galore.
Yep. There's all of that, and hopefully we'll remember the lines and get to the end. No, that's the best show in town.
Yeah.
You start out, you remember the songs, you remember
you
the lines,
make it through.
And you get to the end.
Sharon Gamble with director Bob Harbin and actress Claire Wiltshire. You can see their work in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum at the Theater at the Athenaeum, July 22nd through August 2nd. For more information or tickets, visit bobdirects.com. That's BOBDIREX, bobdirects.com. Or you can give a call to 317-280-0825. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll get a preview of the Ronan Chamber Ensemble season.
I'll check out the new book, Indiana, One Pint at a Time.
And I'll get a preview of the opera's upcoming season. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call...
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.